There, do you have any idea what you're listening to?
London Philharmonic?
It's Venus. Venus.
Why not? We bounced signals off the moon's surface. There's no reason that Venus shouldn't radiate impulses.
I don't mean the static. Can't you hear it, the other thing?
What other thing?
Listen to it, Paul. Listen to the voice.
Hello and welcome to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Riesenell, and I'm your host. So, what kind of award do you give to the folks who are making things up and trying to sell it to you? You give them the falsies. I'll be talking with Diane Farsetta from the Center for Media and Democracy, the folks behind PR Watch, and she's going to tell us who are the big falsie winners this year. You do want to stay tuned. Well, hello, Diane. Thank you very much for joining me tonight.
Oh, my pleasure.
So, maybe just to get started here, you can tell us a little bit more about the Center for Media and Democracy and what you do and why you exist.
Well, we exist because there is so much spinning going on in the world. We're a 15-year-old, basically a media watchdog group. We were founded back in 1993 after John Stauber, our founder and executive director, had an experience of being spied on by Monsanto's PR firm when he was working with some dairy farmers here in Wisconsin. So that was his sort of epiphany that made him realize that there is this just huge multi-billion-dollar, maybe trillion-dollar industry devoted to affecting what we can receive information on, what we think we know about, what we hear about in the news, not to mention, you know, all sorts of events and groups that really aren't what they seem at first glance. So that's the Center for Media and Democracy. We watchdog deceptive public relations tactics and campaigns and try to let people know what's really going on and who's behind these efforts.
So what sort of things are you bringing to light? I mean, where do we see these public relations campaigns? Is it simply when we hear from a representative, a particular company? You know, you might hear them on the news or at a press conference or something, or are there other things which you're uncovering?
Well, there's so much. It's everything from, you know, how someone frames the news, what words, what language is being used. I actually think a great example of when sort of a peek behind the curtain of PR is the recent financial bailout, and the fact that the bill was actually called, the initial bill was actually called a bailout, and that terminology has stuck because it happened, you know, quickly. It happened over a weekend that the administration was trying to get this legislation together, and they just didn't have time to do their usual spin doctoring. So it was called what it actually was, a bailout, instead of, you know, an economic strengthening and conditioning and, you know, good things for everyone bill.
I see. So people might think of a word like friendly fire is a bit of the government side of spinning and PR.
Right.
But you're paying attention, you know, not just to things that happen at the level of government, but you're also paying attention to corporate America, as you mentioned, John Stauber's experience early on with Monsanto's PR firm.
Definitely. And actually, a lot of what we do is more corporate-focused than government-focused, and not because, you know, that's what we decide we want to focus on because we hate corporations, but because, you know, when you talk about PR and who's doing these deceptive things, you're talking about any entity that has a lot of money and something to hide. And more often than not, that's a corporation. You know, whether it's a company that is putting out a fake grassroots group to advocate against, you know, labor rights legislation, or it's, you know, a company that's putting out PR videos and then having them run on news programs as though they were independent news reports. You know, these are all different kinds of PR tactics that As I said, when someone has something to hide and they have a lot of money, this is what they do.
So you mean when I hear that there's some group, some grassroots group that might say, you know, call themselves the Americans for Fair Labor, and they're promoting a bill which would actually cut back on the ability for workers to unionize, you're saying that that might not be a real grassroots group?
Exactly. They always ask, you know, what is this group and where does their money come from? And basically, what are the hidden interests that might be there? You know, a lot of what we do is just asking those questions. You know, who's behind this group? Who's behind this campaign? You know, just basic questions that we encourage everybody to ask when they read the news. And, you know, another thing, another sort of common, probably the most common single PR tactic is called the third party technique, and that's you get someone to speak for you. You sometimes pay them, you're associated with them, but you present them as totally independent. So you're basically putting your words in somebody else's mouth, but then you're pretending, actually, no, this totally independent person or group just happens to agree with me, and you should agree with me too.
Can you give me an example of that?
Sure. Actually, a really good example is the group that won our Golden Falsey for the year, and that's the Pentagon Pundits, which were 75 retired military officers that were cultivated by the Pentagon starting in early 2002. And this idea came from a former PR executive who at the time was working at the Defense Department by the name of Tori Clark. She's now a pundit, so you'll see her. She actually has a book out. So you'll see her on the news sometimes. But back in early 2002, she was at the Defense Department. She was helping Don Rumsfeld figure out how he was going to sell the Iraq War to the American public. And they said, oh, we know some good third-party, you know, advocates. We know who is respected on matters of military and security issues. We know someone who will, you know, a group of people who will tend to toe the party line. And a lot of them are already already, you know, have these gigs as media consultants, and these are these retired military officers who had pundit jobs on mostly on television, although some of them were on radio or had print columns. And they started basically getting this group together, giving them high-level briefings, wooing them with things like, you know, very personalized attention, access to high-ranking officials, free trips to Florida, to Afghanistan, Iraq, Guantanamo Bay. And all the time they told them, you know, look, you can't tell anyone that you're coming to these meetings. You can't tell anyone where you got these talking points from. Just keep on using them. And that's what they did. And they, you know, they not only helped sell the Iraq War, but they brought up every sort of very controversial issue over the last several years, including Afghanistan and the detainees at Guantanamo Bay and warrantless wiretapping. And so these were really the go-to people for the Pentagon. And this was something that was just outed earlier this year by the New York Times. There was 8,000 pages of documents that were released that we were able to make text searchable and put on our website. And there's a wealth of information in there about what is an illegal covert propaganda campaign by our government.
And you were referring to General Barry McCaffrey, who is a pundit analyst, so-called, for NBC News, and the New York Times outed him. It seems that he has a lot of ties, financial ties, to military contractors, and also is not exactly an opponent of war on the news. Why are these folks willing to do this? I mean, so I guess with Barry McCaffrey, we draw this line that he does have an interest in war machinery, essentially. Why are these other folks, these other retired military officers and such, willing to toe the line for the Pentagon there in their gigs as what I think people assume are independent analysts?
Mm-hmm. Right. A lot of them, not just McCaffrey, a lot of them are also lobbyists or consultants for defense contractors. So they can get inside information for their clients. They can advertise the fact that they have this high-level access and get more clients and command higher fees because of this special access. So there's that part of it. But, you know, there is also an ideological part of it. I saw a quite good analysis on the Nieman Media Watchdog site by a retired military officer who's not a pundit. He's actually a teacher. But he went into saying, you know, I don't think a lot of people understand that when you're a retired military officer, you're still in the military. People are still calling you sir. So there's a little bit of groupthink going on. You know, there's a little bit of just belief that that you're still part of the system. You have to be a team player, especially when you're talking about issues of war and peace. A lot of these people also believe that the lesson of Vietnam is not don't start wars of aggression, but rather we need to keep the morale of the U.S. up, and then we will be able to win this war. And so they saw themselves as really information warriors in helping the Defense Department in the war effort. So, you know, it's not necessarily that everyone was making a buck off of this, but that, you know, it was a combination of ideology and entrepreneurial spirit, if you will, that really wound up in what just was really driving a lot of the war, not just the war commentary, but the war coverage of Iraq, especially early on. Was basically Defense Department talking points,
and it continues. But why? What's in it for NBC News to have? I mean, apparently they're paying Barry McCaffrey, so he's not volunteering to come on. They not only have airtime invested, but some cash.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, again, it's this belief that who is better qualified to speak to issues of war, security, you know, military issues than a retired military officer. And, you know, I would take issue with that belief and say, well, actually, you know, you should have humanitarian experts on to talk about what's the impact and of these military operations on the people on the ground. You should talk to people who are actually diplomats who might come up with other ways besides war of dealing with international conflict. You know, there's a whole range of relevant expertise historians. You know, you could say maybe we should have understood better what the histories were of Afghanistan and Iraq and their past experience with being occupied that might, you know, just maybe somehow color their response to a foreign military coming in and quote-unquote liberating them. So this is, you know, raising those questions, pointing out that these people, this wide range of people aren't being represented on the media when we're having literally the most important discussions that ever come up in a democracy, should we go to war or not, is a really important question to ask. But instead of doing that, instead of media doing their job and really facilitating that conversation, they said, well, you know, we're going to go to the military and on top of it, we're not even going to vet them. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think that's an important thing that came out of this as well, is realizing that these channels, these networks had no process, really. They had nothing, no systems in place to even ask, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm, are you working for defense contractors? And that's, you know, that's just sort of stunning.
And now NBC is acting as if it's not a problem, right? I mean, they've been on the offensive against the New York Times for even daring to report on this.
Right, right. And there's actually some emails that came out later that showed that NBC executives were actually coordinating their response along with Barry McCaffrey in reaction to the New York Times' latest story on him. So it's really stunning, and it's just the exact opposite of what we would say an independent, public-minded media should be, how it should operate.
So we've jumped into the falsies here. So you've already revealed the big golden falsy here.
We've already, yeah.
So the suspense is over. But why don't you tell me a little bit more about the falsies and how long you've been doing it and how the organization came up with this award?
Oh, sure. Well, you know, it's basically that time of the year when there tends to be these different retrospectives, and we thought, well, you know, maybe this is something we should do, and actually, let's have a little fun with it. You know, a lot of the work that we do is pretty serious. It's you know, looking at environmental issues, health issues, energy issues, and just saying, you know, these entrenched interests, these corporate, you know, players, how are they spinning things, and just, you know, being very conscientious and documenting what's happening. And we said, you know, let's just have a little fun with this, you know. So we came up with the idea of the Falsies Awards. This is the fifth year that we have done this, and what we do is within our organization, we say, okay, well, who are our nominees? Looking back and seeing what we've written about, who would we say are the worst spinners of the year? And then we come up with our list of nominees, and then we throw it open to a public survey, and we have people come and vote on who we've suggested and also add their own nominees. And it's a lot of fun. People, you know, come on and they have a lot of good, you know, input as to, oh, you know, you forgot this one, or this is why I think this person should get a Falsie, and it's really interesting.
So what's Barry McCaffrey going to get for winning this dubious honor?
Well, you know, we it's a little bit of a tongue-in-cheek award. We actually do have several pairs of Groucho Marx glasses, you know, the glasses with the fake nose and the mm-hmm. and the fuzzy eyebrows and the mustache at the office. So we say, you know, if any of our quote-unquote winners want to come to Madison, Wisconsin, we will gladly give them a pair of Groucho Marx glasses. And actually, one of our winners, I won't reveal who yet, but the Lifetime Achievement Falsie Award winner, someone from his lobbying firm contacted us to ask about that. And I said, well, you know, if you're willing, we, you know, usually we ask people to come to Madison, but the Lifetime Achievement Award is so momentous that we would be willing to mail it to you if you send us a picture of the awardee wearing it. I have not yet.
So maybe your Lifetime Achievement winner wants to wear it like a badge of honor. I'm going to guess that perhaps Barry McCaffrey would like to perhaps even quote or paraphrase Groucho Marx in saying he really doesn't want to be a part of any group that would have him as a member.
That would be a wonderful thing to see him say.
So we've revealed the golden falsies, and you sort of have this. It's sort of like the Olympics here. So you have three levels.
It is.
So why don't we go down to the least falsy of it all? Although that's sort of not saying very much. The bronze level winners. Who wins the bronze?
Sure. The bronze is we titled it Coal is the New Green. And it is basically a campaign by the coal industry and various front groups that it set up. So these are organizations that have these wonderful sounding names like Americans for Balanced Energy Choices. Balance seems good. Energy Choices seems good. How could you be against them? They have since actually renamed themselves. They're now the American Coalition for Clean Coal Electricity. And again, you know, if it's clean, well, you know, isn't it by definition good?
Mm-hmm.
The only problem is that there basically is no such thing as clean coal. This is, you know, the definition of spin here. Basically, the coal industry has fallen on hard times in recent years. The increased attention and understanding and concern about global warming, coupled with the fact that a massive amount of greenhouse gas emissions come from coal-powered power plants, has led to dozens, actually, I think the number is up in the 70s or 80s at this point, of proposed coal plants that have been canceled because local governments, utility boards across the country are saying, you know, it's really not responsible for us to build these new coal plants. So the coal industry panicked and basically said, we need to boost our PR and our marketing budgets. And that's what's happened over the past, really the past year to year and a half. We've seen this vast increase in PR and marketing by them. A lot of ad campaigns. People might be familiar, especially if you watched a lot of the Democratic presidential debates.
Mm-hmm.
The coal industry was advertising during a lot of the debates. They actually co-sponsored a number of the debates. And that was a really interesting sort of positioning on their part, that they went all out during the presidential race and wanted to make sure basically that no matter who was elected, that they wouldn't dare come in with the taking the position that, you know, no, we really shouldn't be building more coal power.
Well, who can be against clean coal? It sounds so good, right? You have the poor mine workers, the coal workers, right, who I think a lot of people can have sympathy for, falling on hard times and very economically depressed areas. And so if clean coal technology will both, advance America's getting away from being dependent on foreign oil and get those workers at work, I mean, who could be against that?
Right. Yeah, and another coal industry front group is called Americans for American Energy. So that's, playing the patriotic card and also the energy security card and saying, the problem with oil is that, you have to go into all these unstable areas of the world, and let's not talk about why they're unstable, but saying, no, coal is American energy, and we don't have to worry about that. There's a lot of positioning, a lot of spinning going on, and it's actually since we really started the Falsies Awards process, the survey and the awarding this year, environmental groups have actually gotten together, and they have a counter-ad campaign, which is pretty funny.
Yeah, I've seen it.
Yes. So, and basically just calling them out and saying, look, there is no such thing as clean coal. It's going to be very interesting to see what happens. Unfortunately, the president-elect, one of his planks in his energy platform is developing clean coal technology and implementing it. So we'll see what happens there. But the environmental and energy issues are really going to be key over the next year, especially.
And now the silver Falsie winner is.
The silver Falsie goes back into issues of war. It's we call it disputing the count of the dead, and basically this is a continued campaign. It's been going on for a few years by mostly sort of right wing ideological both reporters and columnists to call into question basically the best studies that exist into how many Iraqis have died. So these are the two studies. Somewhat famous, somewhat infamous, that were published by the British medical journal Lancet. The 2006 study, the more recent one, estimated that about 650,000 Iraqis had died specifically because of the U.S. invasion from the early 2003 invasion to mid-2006. That's a number that's much larger than a lot of people anticipated, certainly much larger than even mainstream media was reporting or has reported, overwhelmingly since then. So what we saw over the past year, I mean, these have been controversial studies. They haven't gotten a lot of coverage. When they have, they've been criticized. There's, as I said, been this ideological current to the coverage and the criticism of them, not just saying, the data is wrong or the methods are suspect, but really sort of vicious personal attacks against the people who were involved, the researchers who were involved in carrying out these studies, who all have impeccable credentials. But what we saw over the past year was sort of a renewed attack, even though the most recent of these two studies came out in 2006. In early 2008, there was this renewed attack, basically a story in particular called Data Bomb that came out in National Journal that made all of these, personal allegations as well as allegations against the research and what they found. And, we went through and examined that and basically found actually all these charges are pretty easily debunked, once you sit down and once you do the research and figure out what's going on. But there was this whole campaign of editorials that came out of that study, along with a very curious study that was done by the Iraqi Health Ministry along with the World Health Organization, basically taking the same time period as the 2006 Lancet study and saying, well, we want to figure out how many Iraqis have died. They came out with a figure that was less than 25% of the total. So they said, about 150, the number was 151,000 Iraqis have died instead of 650,000. But the interesting thing is that was a spinning in and of itself because that was only part of their data. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the whole data set, what they came up with was actually a total number of casualties that's much closer to the Lancet number.
And we just got a couple of minutes left here, so I don't want to leave out your lifetime achievement award winner.
It's a very important award, and this is the first time, and you know, that we've awarded this. I don't know. I don't think this is going to be a recurring theme. So
we kind of hope not, right? We hope there aren't so many people who deserve the award.
That's right. And so it goes to a man, a lobbyist, Washington, D.C. lobbyist and sort of corporate front guy, Rick Berman. And he is really infamous. I mean, just what he does could almost, you know, keep the Center for Media and Democracy busy almost full time. He's been in D.C. for a long time. He's worked for the tobacco industry in particular, is where he got his start. A lot of longtime flax started there. But so he helped Philip Morris basically back in the 90s deal with these pesky public health advocates by setting up front groups, you know, these organizations that purport to be independent, but they get all of their funding and they take direction from the corporations that fund them, in this case Philip Morris. So they basically created a group called the Guest Choice Network. And the whole idea, again, choice, freedom, these mm-hmm. are very, you know, sort of emotional terms. And the idea was, you know, we don't want people telling us that we can't smoke in even just part of this restaurant. The guest wants to have the choice of where to smoke.
Uh-huh.
So this this group now is called the Center for Consumer Freedom. And again, who could be against consumer freedom? And what it does is it takes money from all these different industry groups, not just tobacco, but alcohol, fast food, restaurants, all sorts of different industry groups. And they do things like not just lobby against public health measures, but lobby against labor rights legislation, you know, basically anything, you know, to help keep down the minimum wage, you know, by lobbying against state and local efforts to raise the local minimum wage. So this is all under the banner of consumer freedom, and he's been doing it so long, and he does it, I don't know if I want to say so well, but he's certainly very determined, and unfortunately, by being very in-your-face and very combative and really going after the real grassroots activist movements, unfortunately, he's been quite effective.
Hmm.
So that's why we gave him the Lifetime Achievement Falsie.
All covered in AstroTurf while he does it.
That's right.
Well, Diane, this has been, of course, eye-opening. If people want to learn more about the Falsie Awards and, of course, many of the other issues you're covering, where can they go?
Sure. Our website is prwatch.org. And we do. We have some Reader's Choice Awards, Dishonorable Mentions, and Win Against Spin Awards, because there's a lot of good work going on out there. So it's prwatch.org.
And notice that you call out factcheck.org, for instance, as a nonpartisan consumer advocate for voters that was helping to really correct a lot of spin out there. And they got they seem to get picked up a lot in the mainstream media during the election cycle, though maybe not enough.
Yeah, and it's been really heartening to see them. I think every cycle, every 4 years, every presidential election, that they do get a little bit more attention, mm-hmm. and they do, along with, you know, a number of other organized groups, and, you know, just good writers, good bloggers are have really called attention to and help sort of real time fact checking what's going on in the elections. There was a lot of, when we did the survey this year for our Falsies Award, as you might guess, we got a lot of feedback around the election. So, and Sarah Palin did win a Reader's Choice Falsie this year. So
I'll leave it with that. Diane, I hope you'll come back on the show, and maybe we can talk more about some of the key things you're researching and learn more about your techniques and how you're able to uncover this stuff. I'd love to have you back on.
Yeah, that would be great.
Thank you very much, Diane, and have a good evening.
You too. Bye-bye.
That's Diane Farsetta from the Center for Media and Democracy. She is a senior researcher there. And once again, their website is prwatch.org. Check out Media Geek online, www.mediageek.net. As well, the radio show is at radio.mediageek.net, where you can download, subscribe to the podcast, or listen in your browser. If you have any comments about the program, please send them to me, Paul@mediageek.net. Thanks for tuning in.